This is work with Ted Jacobson, who's a professor at Maryland. I'm sure many of you know him. He's affiliated here somehow, and he'll be here in the winter, I think, that's for some amount. And an undergraduate, Daniel Brennan. So I'll just start by telling you the physical situation. So forget about where this magnetically dominated plasma is. Just grant me a magnetically dominated plasma. What I mean by that is, let's have some charge around, enough charge to affect the electromagnetic field significantly, but not very much in the sense that there's going to be a strong external field generated by your electromagnet in your lab or a neutron star or something, so strong that the energy density in the field completely dwarfs the rest mass density of the plasma. If you have these two things satisfied, then your description of the physics is incredibly simple, because your energy budget just consists of one term. The energy in this fluid of charged particles is completely negligible. You just throw it away. You have one term, the electromagnetic stress energy tensor. Energy is conserved, and there's a simple calculation that tells you div electromagnetic stress energy tensor equals zero, given Maxwell's equations, is the same as FAB, the field strength, dot J, the charge current, equals zero. This is the Lorentz force density. Normally, you'd have other terms over here with fluid telling you that they feel Lorentz forces. Those terms are gone. You just get that the Lorentz force density itself has to vanish at every point in this plasma. So if you had vacuum fields, J equals zero, of course, this would be automatic, and that's what you're used to thinking of. But if you grant me this small amount of charge, then you get a totally different set of equations for the electromagnetic field. You get just this force-free condition. And the 3 plus 1 version is the charge density times E plus J cross B equals 0. So again, you have charge density around, you have current density around, and they have to be such that at every point this condition is satisfied. And that's called the force-free approximation. The set of equations is really simple. You just have Maxwell's equations here together with that condition. There are no other equations. And in fact, you can just eliminate the current. This equation, you can just say, well, that tells me how to compute the charge current once I know the field strength. But that's just a definition of J. I can plug that J into this equation. And the entire description of this magnetically dominated plasma is the no monopoles Maxwell equation, dF equals zero, and this funny nonlinear equation for F, which says that FAB times div F dotted into div F equals zero. This is force-free electrodynamics. There's nonlinear equations for the electromagnetic field of the plasma. There are no particles around at all. So they're just completely irrelevant to the dynamics of the field. What particles are actually doing may be relevant in nature for your system, but that would be a small perturbation you add on later. In the magnetically dominated regime, you just get these equations for the electromagnetic field. So why is this regime interesting? Can you write an action? Yes, you can write an action for that. I wish I had a slide on that. People would ask that question here. I'll get to it later a little bit, but these fields are degenerate, meaning F wedge F is zero, and that tells you F can be written as alpha wedge beta for one forms, and that tells you that alpha and beta are D of scalar potentials, and if you write the action as D scalar 1, D scalar 2, and minimize that, you can do it. So you're looking confused because that's way too much information. But the answer is yes, you can, but you have to introduce these scalar potentials called Euler potentials. And you can get these equations from minimizing the action with respect to variations of those scalar potentials. A mu, maybe you can, but of course if you just write down the normal action for A mu and minimize it, you'll get vacuum. You'd have to add your charge current in as some external source, you know, in the usual way. So I don't know how to do the action with A mu, but if you use these scalar potentials, so this, if you write F this way and then construct F squared and minimize with respect to phi 1 and phi 2, then you get these equations in terms of phi 1 and phi 2. It's not in the talk at all, though. Okay. Yeah, quantizing would be interesting. I'm not sure what it means. I'm not sure what the quanta of these scalar fields would be.
I was just
Oh. But I think it'll be fun to quantize them.
You have very strange sense of humor.
What?
You have very strange sense of humor here. Actually, no, that's what Ken wanted to begin doing when he found this work by, what's his name?
Uchida?
Yeah.
Yeah, Uchida worked out a lot of this after a suggestion of Carter, actually. Yeah, it's one of the things. I mean, when I got to, this all started because when I got to Maryland, Ted said, hey, there's these cool equations. Let's find something to do with them. And then I guess originally maybe he was thinking of quantizing, but I'm not sure that makes any sense physically. Yeah. Yeah, or even, I just don't even know what the quanta would be. I mean, it's quanta of little balls of magnetically dominated plasma field. It's kind of weird.
It's not entirely unthinkable. I think, isn't it true in situations like this, you can get like quantum, like things comparable to Schrödinger, for example?
Absolutely. The fields can get really strong. Magnetar fields are 10 to 15 gauss up to that, and that is this critical field strength. But that would be, you'd expect, you know, electron-positron creation. And I agree, it'd be really interesting to work out how to do that self-consistently with the fields in some set of equations, but I don't think quantizing force-free is the way to go. You have to put in that you have, you know, electron field in your equation. Force-free has no idea. It's just the electromagnetic field, right? The charges are not appearing in the description. So you'd have to have more of a QED-like action than a pure force-free action.
Out the charges. But the point is that charges are not in vacuum. They're real. So they're real particles.
Right? Field is highly constrained. So as you said, if you go back and then you already think that, then you can say, oh, this is the current that is producing the field.
Yeah, so if you solve these equations for F, classical equations, you know the field. You can always go ahead and compute div F and say, oh yeah, that's what the charges and currents are doing. They're real charges and currents, and it's a plasma. They're really there, they're just not. You just don't know exactly, if given the current charge density, you don't know whether it's like 10 electrons or 12 electrons and 2 protons. Those would be the same thing. Force free doesn't tell you.
But I mean, I think I kind of agree that since they don't have any, they don't dynamics, or because everything follows this field, you should be able to write, well, certainly equations don't have the charges appearing in them, right? So, I mean, there might be an action, basically. It's equivalent to integrating out the charges, but it's not the ordinary integrating act. Ordinarily, in quantum computer, yes, you think that you integrate out sitting in their vacuum. They're not, they don't exist. They're not particles of that existence. But here they are, they do it. So, but I think that's an interesting exercise, maybe. It's possible.
Yeah, I haven't done that. Okay, well, if there's this much discussion on every slide, we'll get through 10%, but it'll be fun. So I have, you know, 5 or 6 slides on convincing you why these are interesting in nature, but everyone was so interested even without that, that maybe I shouldn't spend too much time. I mean, these equations go back all the way to 1969, which is 1 year after pulsars were discovered, when Goldreich and Julian pointed out that the fields are so strong that they would actually rip charges off the surface of the star. If you didn't have charges already outside the star, they'd get ripped off. So you actually have to have a magnetosphere, and it has to be force-free. I'll go through that. They're very good arguments. So in these extreme magnetic fields, you really have these equations describing the electromagnetic field. And then there's Blanford and Zinayak several years later suggesting that black holes power, you know, the relativistic jets seen in AGN. There, it's not so clear you really have this force-free magnetosphere, but it's certainly plausible. And there's, if you take that, there's definitely lots of interesting stuff to explore for black hole space-times hosting force-free plasma. So very quickly, a pulsar is a coherent radio signal with a periodicity. They are rotating magnetized neutron stars. They can't be anything else. They're rotating. The period here is too quick. And from the increase in the period, the spin-down rate, you can infer the strength of the magnetic field, assuming it's a dipole that's radiating in a standard way. As it rotates, so the dipole field is misaligned with the spin and it emits energy, it spins down, and you can conclude from that rate that you have these enormous magnetic fields of B 10 to the 12 gauss, and they go up and down on either side 3 orders of magnitude. So it's extremely strong magnetic field. And here quickly is what Goldreich and Julian taught us. They said, suppose that pulsar we're surrounded by vacuum. It's a rotating dipole, it's surrounded by vacuum. You can work out this Lorentz invariant E dot B, and you get some formula. But the thing is conducting. It's a neutron star, so inside E has to be zero. So the Lorentz invariant E dot B equals zero. So there's some transition from a value outside to zero, and that's perfectly reasonable until you realize just how big this value is outside, okay? So as the thing goes from this big value to zero, somewhere inside the crust of the neutron star, you still have a big thing. And to get a sense of how big, you can compare the various forces on all the charges. The electric force due to this component of E along the magnetic field, and say the gravitational force for this compact object, and it's this gigantic ratio, okay? Now, there are other forces involved. We don't know what the structure of the crust is. We don't have all the equations, but this is a sense of how much you have to overcome if you want to keep charges on the star. So it really stretches the imagination that you could have a pulsar in vacuum. And the conclusion is charges would be ripped off, and the pulsar has to have this plasma magnetosphere. Now, I'm not saying the charges necessarily come from it getting ripped off. There are lots of ideas. Pair production of electron-positron pairs could populate the outside. The point is that by this simple argument, it can't be vacuum, and so you need this magnetosphere. Why do I say it's force-free, or why did they say it's force-free? Well, the point is you have to neutralize this huge E dot B to avoid that argument I just gave you. So you can do an order of magnitude estimate of how much charge you need to do that, and it's this formula. And if you plug in the typical parameters for pulsars, you get a number density of charges of 10 to the 9 per centimeter cubed. So that's a reasonable density. It would be called a low density plasma here on Earth. But, you know, it's reasonable. Until you realize just how big the magnetic fields are compared to it. So this 10 to 12 magnetic field is just enormous, right? MRI machines would have 10 to the 4 Gauss. This is 10 to the 12 Gauss. So if you compare the energy density of the fields to the rest mass density of the particles, you get this 10 to the minus 19. It's incredibly force-free. This is a completely solid application of these equations. Now, in this argument, I actually didn't say it, but I wrote it. I assumed that this was one species of charge, so they're all negative charges. But of course, it's only the net charge that contributes. So in principle, you could have that much net charge plus, you know, 10 to the 20 electrons and 10 to the 20 positrons or something. So, I mean, it's conceivable, but, well, I don't know. Since this sets a natural scale for, you know, how much you need, it's pretty unlikely that you would make that up by also having another 10 to the 20, you know, electron-positron pairs around. So that's why pretty much everybody believes that the magnetosphere is force-free. And I thought I'd get into it with a bit of slideshow about the history of this field. Goldreich and Julian drew this picture for how the magnetosphere should look. The equations were solved numerically in 1999. These are for so-called aligned pulsars, where the spin axis is vertical and the magnetic axis is vertical. So it's stationary and axisymmetric, and you can make progress. But of course, that kind of pulsar wouldn't pulse. The pulsing pulsar was done by Spitkovsky in 2006. Where you have a misaligned, here you have the magnetic axis that way, but the spin axis vertically. And then on the bottom are some pictures from black holes. Blandford and Zanayak drew that. Komissarov solved the equations. And then here we have a lovely picture from Luis and collaborators of two black holes immersed in a force-free plasma with a constant uniform, with a uniform magnetic field providing the magnetic domination. So that was the introductory section, and now I want to tell you, you know, at least why I'm so excited to be working on these equations. So I hope I'll show you some of the lovely properties they have just as equations, as in a mathematical sense. And they really apply in nature to pulsars, and they may also apply to a host of other things. There's lots of activity using these in terms of trying to explain gamma ray bursts and active galactic nuclei, these large jets. And even if you don't care about astrophysics, I just think it's interesting in a basic sense to explore the dynamics of charged matter in these extremely strong electromagnetic fields. And so the rest of the talk is going to be exploring. Some time for exploration. Okay, so that was the little introduction. There's going to be a bit on the math and physics of force-free. This is all review, but in our language, which I hope will be your language as well. Then a bit about how field lines in force-free tend to open. I'll explain what that means. And then finally, what we found recently are a bunch of exact solutions that don't have any symmetries at all, and that we think apply to some of this physics. So there's one paper out. It's on the archive and published. Very soon, there'll be another one. And then we're also writing up, Ted and I, this long, somewhat review, somewhat new stuff paper where we're taking what we've learned in our year or so of studying fairly intensively what's known and writing it in a language that makes more sense to us. So if you like the language I'm using today and the content, look for this one. This will be a nice review. That is, we found some exact solutions that correspond to a pulsar when it's being accelerated by some external force, so like in a binary, but we're not doing the binary explicitly, we're just putting the pulsar on a time-like world line, and I have some solutions I claim should represent part of the magnetosphere for that pulsar. I'll get there, it's in the talk. Okay, so I'm just repeating this slide to remind everyone what force-free is. Maxwell's equations plus vanishing Lorentz force density, and you can plug the one on the left into the one on the right, and it's a nonlinear equation for the electromagnetic field. And this equation, it's not at all obvious from writing it that way, but this equation turns out to be deterministic. So it makes good physical sense for classical physics. You can set up your initial data and let it go. And I think it's helpful to go through that also to gain intuition for how these equations work. So to do a kind of initial value analysis, you have to make a 3 plus 1 split. And so in the standard way in flat space time, we have Maxwell's evolution equations, we have Maxwell's constraint equations, and then the force-free condition. And if you use some algebra, you can actually solve for the 3 current J in terms of the field. So any solution to this top bit, force-free, we'll have current J that equals this crazy solution of the fields. And in fact, sometimes the equations are just presented this way. You know, take Maxwell and have this crazy current. You can also see from this condition by dotting with E, with B rather, that E dot B is going to be zero for any solution. So the idea is let's add that to the list of constraints. Div B equals zero is one, E dot B equals zero.
Point of this equation is that it doesn't rely on time derivatives. It's J with no time derivatives.
Yes, this allows you to plug J back into down here, back into Maxwell's evolution equations, and view this whole thing as an evolution problem where you're not going to have this funny extra thing around. You're just going to say I have two constraints that tell me like what my initial data has to satisfy, div b equals zero and e dot b equals zero. And now this J is just some crazy function of E and B, so you can just solve these equations on a computer, and when Luis and others do that, that's exactly what they do. Right, and I was just gonna say, div E equals rho doesn't count as a constraint anymore, that's just the definition of rho. So that's just gone from the equations in case, unless you wanna know what the charge density is. And then, you know, so this has the typical form of a nice evolution problem, but you don't know it makes any sense until you do this analysis of hyperbolicity, the property you want for causal equations with a well-posed initial value formulation, and it turns out these are hyperbolic if this Lorentz invariant b squared minus e squared is greater than zero. So that's f squared, field strength squared, and this is telling you you need magnetic domination for these equations to make sense as an initial value formulation. Okay, I tell me who.
Paper, but there's been a series of papers shown.
Well, Komissarov was the first, right? So did I miss some in between? No, I don't think anyone was before him. Did you do this, for example? I wouldn't be surprised.
Not before him, but
somewhere in between? Okay, why don't you tell me the reference? I just don't know. I mean, there are a lot of papers out there. I haven't read them all. But anyway, I think they at least showed symmetric hyperbolicity. I don't think that was done before. Anyway, magnetic domination, for what it's worth. So now this is still all review, but this is a lovely property of the equations that was first pointed out by Carter and was picked up by a fellow named Uchida and hasn't been discussed since then as far as I can tell, but it's quite lovely. So one way to see it is the following. So here's the force free condition, f dot j equals 0. That means j is a 0 eigenvector of the matrix f, if you wish. But f is an anti-symmetric matrix, so there's another 0 eigenvector. So at every point in space-time, there's a plane, a 2D plane of vectors that annihilate f in this sense. If you have this magnetic domination, which you really need for the equations to make sense, then you can work out that that plane is actually time-like. So what's the interpretation of the time-like plane? Well, if you pick a time-like unit vector in that plane, that is going to satisfy, if that unit vector is u, that's going to satisfy FAB UB equals 0. And that FAB UB is nothing but the electric field measured by the observer u. So this is telling you that that observer is measuring 0 electric field. So the time-like vectors in this plane are observers that see pure magnetic fields. And the orthogonal space-like vector is just the B field that that observer sees. Now, what makes this really nice is the no-monopoles Maxwell equation, df equals 0, that turns out to be exactly the Frobenius condition for these planes integrating up into nice surfaces. Okay? So any solution of force-free is foliated, and if it's magnetically dominated, it's foliated by time-like two surfaces, which are characterizing all the observers who see pure magnetic fields. So, you know, if you like thinking about invariants, you don't like magnetic field lines that much because they're observer dependent. But in this context, you can think of these two surfaces as the world sheet of a magnetic field line. And it's sort of the magnetic field lines according to observers who didn't see any electric field. And so it's a very helpful thing for understanding the structure of solutions and the way the magnetic field is behaving in an invariant way. So this is all review, but we're at least contributing a name. We're calling it the field sheets, thinking about the world sheet for a string. This is the world sheet of a field line. Okay, more review about the physics of these equations. I think you can get into it very nicely by just thinking about one known exact solution that was discovered in 1973 by Curtis Michael. And here it is in two forms. In the 3 plus 1 form, we have an E theta electric field, a B phi magnetic field, and they fall off like 1 over r and they're equal. And then we have a radial magnetic field falling off like 1 over r squared. Okay, that's a magnetic monopole. Just grant me the monopole for now. The astro people like to think of the monopole charge as, you know, giving the field strength B0 at the surface of the star r, but over here I'm just going to think of it as the monopole charge q. And here's the way you can write this exact same solution in space-time. It's one language, thinking of f as a differential, it's one equation, thinking of f as a differential form, it's this expression. So omega for now is just a parameter, but we can help figure out what the parameter is by working out these field sheets. So the field sheets, again, are spanned at every point by two vectors that annihilate f, FAB, VB equals 0. And you can see from up here what those vectors are. So one is t plus r, the radial outgoing null vector. You can see that because here's a dt minus dr. So when you hit this with t and r, this term will give 0, and this also gives 0 because there's just theta and phi. So the radial null vector annihilates this field strength. And the other one is this rotating frame vector, t plus omega phi. You can see that from the dt, the minus omega dt, and the plus d phi. So just by inspection, you can work out what these field sheets are. And if you plot them, they look something like this. How are these helpful in figuring out the physics? Well, these fields are singular at the origin, OK? You could think of so you can't really take them seriously there. But there's an observation that if this, for sufficiently small r, this vector is time-like and represents the world line of a rotating observer, and it's, then this vector satisfies FAB KB equals 0. That's exactly no electric field, and conductors are surfaces, are solids or whatever, where observers rotating with the conductor or moving with the conductor see no electric field. So this is telling you that this solution can be matched to a conductor that's rotating with angular velocity omega, and you can view that conductor as the source of the solution. The other thing about the solution is that there's a net energy flux of 2/3 q squared omega squared in this stationary solution. So that's unusual. Vacuum electromagnetic fields don't transport energy when they're stationary. You need time dependence acceleration to produce radiation. But this does, and you can see that from here, that you have 1/r falloff even though the fields are stationary. So the point of this exercise is to introduce you to the key idea, which is really the idea that underlies why pulsars emit so much energy, which is that when you have a force-free magnetosphere and you have a rotating conductor, you generate an outgoing energy flux. Now, this had a magnetic monopole, so you might think it's artificial, but it's not that artificial. So one thing you can do is just split the monopole in this sense, okay? So you just literally take positive monopole charge Q in the northern hemisphere and negative charge Q in the southern hemisphere, and then you have no net magnetic flux through any surface. You have no actual magnetic monopoles. Instead, you have a sheet of current on the equator. And you can think of this as a poor man's model of a dipole. But it's actually even better than that. For some reason that I do not fully understand, but I have now in some sense mathematically proven, and these people all seem to just know, if you have a dipole, but you give it a force-free external magnetosphere, in vacuum, the dipole field lines will all come around and close and go back to the star. But actually in force-free, they open. The field lines open up and go all the way to infinity, and they never come back. So Goldreich and Julian just sort of said this, and it definitely entered the standard picture. Here's some other pictures of it over the years. And I'll go into the arguments for it in a minute, but I'll just say that when you do solve the equations numerically, you do see that the field lines open and that the split monopole exterior does form. Okay. So I'll go through this quickly because often the audience is, you know, completely invested in this argument, whereas maybe people here have never even heard of it. But basically what you see in the literature is an argument on the following lines, which is that, well, in force-free, particles are stuck on field lines. I'm not sure why that's supposed to be true. I think that intuition comes from zero temperature, ideal MHD, which is not what we're doing, but maybe there's some limiting process. But anyway, maybe they're stuck on field lines, and then there's this idea that field lines are... Yeah, but that's not exactly stuck. I mean, for this argument to work... Yeah, but there's also drift velocity from field line to field line and, you know, thermal effects. I mean, they can avoid being exactly on field lines. But this argument is going to say they're exactly on field lines. And then the problem is that these field lines rotate for some reason. And because they rotate, if the field lines were closed, there'd be no way to escape going faster than the speed of light if you were really stuck on the field lines. Whereas for an open field line, there's this idea that, well, yes, the open field line is also rotating faster than the speed of light, but somehow you can move backwards along the field line in the phi direction relative to it at also faster than the speed of light and come out okay. Well, I don't know. Maybe you can explain this to me. I bet there's something to it because it convinced everybody and they were right. But at the very least, it doesn't seem physically satisfying to explain what the force-free solution is doing invoking particles, because those are playing no role in the dynamics of the system.
Because
the particles are playing no role in the dynamics of the system, right? They're completely gone from the equations. You can have all sorts of force-free... You can have a force-free configuration with completely different particles sourcing it, right? That you really don't know what they're doing. So at the very least, it's unsatisfying physically to explain some property of force-free by invoking what the particles are doing.
But the particles have come from the equation, but are part of the physics. So if you're looking for a physical explanation, then that's based on particles.
No, it could be based on dynamics of fields and charges. I mean, the physical explanation is also based on quarks because there are real quarks, you know, inside some of those particles maybe, but it's very unsatisfying to invoke quarks to explain this stuff. To me, it's equally unsatisfying to invoke particles. I mean, it's really all about the fields and the charges.
Well, charges are particles.
Yes, but there's a difference that you only know the net charge. You don't know which kind of particles are there and what they're doing. I don't need to hang my whole talk on this argument not being convincing, but at the very least, that's why I'm not particularly convinced. There's a better argument, which is a numerical argument, which is just basically set up a rotating dipole that's conducting and let it go. And you see the field lines emerge. So to me, that's more convincing evidence that this really happens. But there's one loophole, which is, remember, you needed magnetic domination, B squared greater than E squared, in order for these equations to make any sense. And when you throw them on a computer, you find that dynamically, even if you started with that condition, it actually ends up being violated. Electric fields get bigger. Really what happens is magnetic fields get small. And so what do people do? Well, starting with Spitkovsky, he just said, well, if E gets big, I'm just going to make it small again. I'm literally at each step in my code going to check. And if E got big, I'm going to rescale it back down to equal the magnetic field. So it's definitely somewhat ad hoc. On the other hand, you do expect some other physical process to take over there and to, you know, restore magnetic domination in some way. Because, I mean, something has to happen. And when you have electric fields, they accelerate particles and short out electric fields and so on. But in any case, it's not purely within force free, and it is a little ad hoc.
Can I ask, in the rotating frame, so the field lines, even the open field lines, are stationary in the rotating frame, they're
mm-hmm.
do they curve backwards or forwards relative to the azimuth?
Backwards or forwards? You mean relative to the spin?
Yeah,
it's with the spin. So they go around in a helix. I have a picture of this.
So that's what you're saying, they have to flow
backwards. Yeah. Yeah, so the field lines are kind of doing... The field lines kind of look like this.
I see. And when you actually out there calculate from force free what the J is,
yeah.
If you do indeed see that it's pointing backwards along the field lines?
No, the J actually is completely radial. Far away. It's
So how is that? You mean so that somehow the part preserve causality of the particles have to flow backwards along the field lines, but that's not what J says.
No, the particles have little to do with J. The J is the net, right? J is the sum of the positive and negative charges.
So is there some arrangement of charges flowing backwards along the field line that would give a J? Somehow I don't see how is it consistent. Is there any arrangement?
I think so. I mean, people do work this out. They take a limit as ideal MHD goes to force free and talk about their ideal MHD particles within the solution.
I guess the fields and the particles are not actually just flowing off the field lines. They're kind of whirling around it or something like that. That should account for
that. There is an electric field too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure I should have this slide because people ask me questions about this argument and, you know, I can't really explain it.
One thing, of course, as you said, is resetting P to B is kind of not a very comfortable thing to do. But you can also check where you're actually doing it. I mean,
it's in the sheet. Yeah, right. I'll get to that.
Field lines opening up already, it's happening
Yeah.
Far from where you're actually doing anything right now.
Yeah. No, that's right. And in fact, the fact that you need to do this at the current sheet is very nice because you don't expect the current sheet to be force-free anyway. There's a nice consistent picture here that force-free really has a hard time applying globally. Even if you try, it just kind of ends up breaking down somewhere. And you see that numerically in this failure. And I'm going to show you how you see that analytically as well.
I think one thing happens if E squared is bigger than V squared, you have Schunker pair production until field becomes
But the thing is, you already have enough particles to neutralize the electric field, right? I mean, force free satisfies E dot B equals zero. So making more particles, I don't see why that's going to help. You already have enough. They just move around in order to avoid being accelerated with positive E dot B. So I don't understand that argument either.
I guess I'm not quite fine. So you're saying that
I agree, yeah, force-free breaks down. But I don't think physically Schwinger pair production is probably the right answer for what takes over and restores force-free. I think it has to be something else. EM duality? What do you mean? Oh, you mean dualing, dualizing the field. Yeah, you can't dualize these fields and get new solutions because they're non-vacuum. So the dualing thing, you have magnetic monopoles, right? If you dual. Yeah, so it's pretty easy to see. If you have a solution of Maxwell's and you just ask, is star F a solution? Then, of course, one Maxwell equation is df equals 0. So d, the new f is d star f equals 0. But, of course, d star f is exactly the original j. So you need j equals 0 to have duality work. J of the original one had to be 0, yeah. Okay. So what I was going to set up is, at the very least, you know, some people will be convinced by this one, some by this one, maybe by both, maybe some people by both. At the very least, it'd be nice to also have some kind of mathematical argument. And I actually haven't seen one. So in part to convince myself that this was right, you know, Ted and I have gone through and we've given a mathematical argument. So I don't have time, especially with all the questions, to go through it. But I'll just show you the character. We basically just made a bunch of assumptions. You know, symmetries of the space-time, electromagnetic field has the same symmetries. The star has to be rigidly rotating and perfectly conducting and has a magnetization that's kind of like a dipole. And we were able to just prove that closed field lines have to remain within this light cylinder, the region where co-rotating observers with the star would be moving less than the speed of light. So this is not that satisfying to me because it doesn't answer the physical question of why they're opening. Which maybe ultimately will involve particles, although I wouldn't be that satisfied with that. But in any case, we have filled this gap in the literature, and we've actually made less assumptions than normally, fewer assumptions than normally made. We didn't pick flat space-time or any particular space-time. It's just observer. You still have a notion of co-rotation. There's one angular velocity of the star, and so you can ask about the vector d by dt plus that angular velocity d by d phi. Oh yeah, I'm assuming stationary d and x.
I mean, I guess I'm just wondering if it's not a flat space-time, then you need a local definition of the speed.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's simply these observers are co-rotating. Guys with dt plus omega d phi. That's my notion of co-rotation. She just asked, is this vector time-like? If it's time-like, these observers are less than the speed of light. And the place where it's null is called the light cylinder. It's not a cylinder necessarily in Kerr spacetime, but it's still the light cylinder. And in fact, in black hole spacetime, there's two. Two regions where this becomes null. OK. So I can't show you any details, but we did do that. And now that everybody in the room believes in the opening of magnetic field lines, there's an interesting consequence, which is, if you gave it a dipole, in the black hole space-time, I think one of them is always in the ergosphere, but I'm not sure about that. I haven't worked it out yet. It's on my list of things to check. So there's definitely the usual light cylinder, which has, you know, in a neighborhood of infinity, you know, where space-time is. For neutron stars with an ergosphere, those probably have other problems, right? I mean, it must be instabilities. But yeah, they might have two light surfaces. It's very easy to check, right? You just write this out and see where it vanishes. That would be interesting. We haven't figured this out, but I do think a very interesting thing to do would be to actually have a nice connection between energy extraction and ergospheres. Figure out what's going on there. Okay, the point I was making was if you have dipole field lines which would go out in the north and come back in the south, but you're having them open, the point is in this open region, these ones are going out, these ones are going in, so they're actually changing sign on the equator. So you actually get a current sheet. This is telling you there's some azimuthal current flowing to change the sign. of the magnetic field. And this current sheet is certainly not force-free, okay? So even analytically, you can say, I'm gonna try my best to have global force-free. I'm assuming it holds everywhere except for maybe some set of measure zero or something, and you derive that on a set of measure zero it's violated. So it's a really nice way of seeing that force-free has a problem applying globally. This is just to show you what happens in the inclined case. So Spitkovsky was the first to do this. You still have your closed field lines, which go into open field lines separated by a current sheet, but now this current sheet has this curving behavior, and in fact, I'll show you later, it wiggles like this. You get this oscillating current sheet. And that probably does play some role in why you see periodicity and emission from pulsar winds and things like that. And then finally, for black holes, Blanford-Zaniak, I'll start with a result of McDonald and Thorne, which we've shored up some details of the proof, but mainly, again, we've just given it a name. We're calling this the no ingrown hair theorem. The point is black holes, when you have force-free outside, not vacuum, you can have magnetic field lines coming out of the black hole, but they just can't go back in unless they pass through some non-force-free region. So that's the no ingrown hair theorem. And just to tell you about this Blanford-Zaniak paper, since it's a very famous paper, what they did, among other things, is they took this Michael monopole solution and they literally just promoted it to Kerr by identifying the flat space-time spherical coordinates with Boyer-Lindquist coordinates and interpreting it as a solution valid to some order in A. They had a different language, but this is effectively what they did. And you see that previously in flat space-time, this omega was the rotation velocity of the conductor. But actually in a black hole, it turns out you demand this field is regular on the horizon, and it implies that omega is 1/2 the horizon angular velocity. So this is the kind of prototypical toy model for energy extraction by force-free processes from a spinning black hole. The Blanford-Zaniak effect is described by many people, but to me this is the Blanford-Zaniak effect. It's the fact that you can get energy out of a spinning black hole in stationarity and axisymmetry. Okay, so I'm actually perfectly fine with most of the talk being review because it's all really interesting, I think. And you guys will probably like it more than hearing the new stuff, but here's what I've reviewed. Unlike the vacuum case, force-free fields can transport energy and angular momentum when they're stationary. That's a key new difference in force-free electrodynamics. You can get this from rotating magnetized conductors or spinning black holes. There's this funny property that closed field lines tend to open, implying this current sheet. When it's an inclined pulsar, that sheet wiggles, and you can't have closed field lines at all for black holes. Okay, and now I'm gonna spend 10 minutes showing you some of the new stuff we did in terms of exact solutions. So it starts with a really simple observation that, as far as I know, nobody's made before, of this old 1973 solution. It has the following property, that in units where the speed of light is 1, this Michael monopole solution, the 3 current density J is equal to the charge density rho. So it's just some statement. But if you think in a space-time way, that's exactly the statement that the charge current 4 vector is null, right? You would put this guy in the time slot, this guy in the space slot, and with the minus sign from the Minkowski signature, you'd find out that J, the 4 current vector, was null. Actually, the only known exact solution in Kerr turns out to also have a null current. They don't emphasize it, but these people did point it out that the current in the solution they found by some other method is proportional to the ingoing principal null direction of Kerr. So there's some connection between null currents and force-free solutions, you know, at least, if not in the physics, at least in terms of the way we find solutions. I really shouldn't spend too much time on this, but null currents have been studied before, going back to 1913, actually. This is an excerpt from a 1923 paper where he's thinking about null solutions as light darts, which represent electricity that travels with the velocity of light. So I like to bring this up because that's really not the way to think about it. That's really a misconception. Null charge current does not mean you have a particle moving at the speed of light. If you only had one sign of charge, you would need particles moving at the speed of light to get a null current. But you have 2 signs of charge. And so one way of making a null current is to, you know, this is my idea of what it's like to do an experiment. You get your battery and your resistor, and you put it on the table, and you make a circuit. You calculate how much J that was, and you say, oh, I need this much rho. So you go grab your bag of protons, and you drop them on the current, and that's your null fork current. Okay, so in the inclined pulsar magnetosphere, here's this wiggling current sheet. In fact, despite all this complicated structure, you know, this is in these pictures, in fact, the current far away from the pulsar turns out to be null and radial. So it's not just these exact solutions that are artificial. Even in the real case, outside the light cylinder, the current becomes very approximately null and radial. It does interesting things. It switches sign on the equator. But actually, if you talk to the guys who wrote these papers, who are at Goddard, two of them anyway, the current really is null and radial. So by thinking about null currents, you can actually find physical solutions. Yeah, right. If you take it seriously and have it all the way out to infinity, it's just filling up this cone set by the inclination angle of the magnetic field relative to the spin axis. But of course, you know, how far does the force-free magnetosphere actually extend? It's not clear, but it's certainly not all the way to infinity. but yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on here that I think should play a role in emission from these systems, and there are definitely people working on that. So the cartoon version is this, that there's crazy stuff going on, current sheet, magnetic field lines, but nevertheless, the current is pretty approximately radial and null. So what we did is we looked for radial null solutions, and actually we found all of them. Not just stationary ones, not just axisymmetric ones. No, no, no. Just that they're actually somewhat interesting. So this solution does not have exactly null current. It has asymptotically null current, but actually the guys say it's a pretty good approximation in this picture for like the out. If I exclude this region, the current is pretty well null out here. No, it's definitely not null in here because I know that about the solution. I don't have time to explain how they solve it in there. But no, I don't think. In fact, you can see in the stationary and axisymmetric case, you can actually prove the only null radial current solution is this Michael monopole solution, and that's a genuine split monopole where the sheet goes all the way into the star, and God decided to magnetize the star in this bizarre split monopolar pattern. If you give it a dipole, it can't be null everywhere, but it is asymptotically null, and the asymptotics are interesting because of this current sheet. All right, 5 minutes. Okay, well, I'll just skip the Newman-Penrose formalism. People here must know a little bit about null structure. The point is, it's very useful to look at null directions in your space-time. This is basically how Kerr was found, how the perturbations were found. And Newman-Penrose uses a null tetrad, and instead of the field strength, an antisymmetric tensor, you use three complex scalars. And this is very good for solving force-free, if you have null current, because if you assume J is null along some direction L, then the force precondition, FAB JB equals zero, just becomes FAB LB equals zero. And you can see lots of FAB LBs up here in the definition of the scalars, so phi zero just vanishes, and the real part of phi one just vanishes. So the force precondition just becomes this, and then you can just write out Maxwell's equations and just straight up integrate them. This is before even picking a metric or a particular null direction, or you think of it as a null congruence, filling up space-time. And you can get some general results, which I don't have time to go through, but you can learn things like if you're looking for a particular type of solution, that the null congruence that the current is along has to be geodesic and shear-free. Results of that character. But more interesting for the astrophysics is just to go ahead and solve this. So in flat space-time, but also in Schwarzschild, you can do this. You can just find the general solution with null radial current, and it takes this form. You get exactly this magnetic monopole, and then you find you have an arbitrary function psi that's constant along the null direction, wedged with the null direction. So this is like L wedged d psi, and in spherical coordinates it looks like this. The Michael monopole is one such solution, but other such solutions would correspond to choices of q and psi that are now depend on angles and are time dependent. And assuming the numerical people are right, that the current really is null and radial, we could look at their code and actually figure out which psi describes their solution out here. And then you'd have an analytic description of this outer region with the current sheet and all the what the fields are doing. And I think that would be very useful. Or you can do the split monopole case. Here's that picture of field lines. Just as a toy model for a pulsar where you now assume the current is radial everywhere, and then you need the sheet going all the way into the star. And actually, with our solutions, we don't have to limit ourselves to just this Michael case. We can also have the conducting sphere move around in an arbitrary way, and we can still match our solutions to it and determine a choice of Q and psi. So you can imagine a conducting sphere doing whatever it wants, and we actually give you the exact split monopolar magnetosphere. You can also have the inclination of the split monopole magnetization be different from the star itself. This was done by, from the spin axis, this was done by Bogovelov, and he got this wiggling current sheet, so I made a movie of it. And I don't have a movie of the more complicated case, but I want to emphasize that actually our solutions do include a split monopole magnetized star doing literally whatever you wanted, an arbitrary function of time in terms of its rotation axis and rotation speed. As long as the center mass is fixed, we have an exact solution. There's a lovely result that you can understand how the current sheets move by the behavior of these field sheets, but I don't have time. Then this accelerated bit, which is coming out soon, actually you can do the null current along the light cones of an arbitrary time-like world line. So the null radial current was the case of a stationary world line just sitting there. But actually you can still solve the equations for an arbitrary world line. And we're interpreting that as what happens when a pulsar gets accelerated by some companion or some other force. And you find that instead of the magnetic monopole, you get the dual of the Leonard-Weikert field for a moving magnetic monopole on this world line. And you still have...
Minkowski,
yeah.
Not the binary.
Well, it's treating the binary as an external source accelerating world line in Minkowski. I mean, it's like the Newtonian physics type description of a binary. But there's only one star currently.
So what is the solution?
The general solution, again, with no symmetries, has two terms. One is the field of a magnetic monopole charge on the line, which is the magnetic dual of the Larmor field, of the Leonard-Weikert field. And then the same thing, this L is the generators of these null cones, and you wedge it with d psi, some field that is constant along the null cones. And you need that, if u is the four velocity, that L is normalized this way. And this simple equation is the general solution to these crazy nonlinear force-free equations when the current is along the light cones. So you can work out what the power is, and you won't be surprised that you get a Larmor-type flux from the first term, and you get a second term, which is basically what you would get for a pulsar with the same parameters as the accelerated one, so you can work out the scaling of the acceleration because you know by dimensional analysis how the monopole charge has to be related to the dipole moment. Again, the dipole pulsar opens up into a split monopole with an effective charge. So you can work out the scaling. I don't think the scaling has been seen numerically, but that's one of the things I want to talk to Luis about later. So there's a bunch more slides, but I'll just flash them up in case people want to ask me later. You can do exact solutions in Kerr, but it's not as pretty. And the interesting thing about the exact solutions we found in black hole space times is that they represent a kind of non-scattering wave. So here's the differential forms version of our solutions for Schwarzschild, where these are ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. And the point is this free function, which I'm now calling S in the black hole case, it's a function of ingoing time and angles. So you can think of it as giving initial data, say, for some wave packet at past null infinity. And this solution just doesn't depend on the radial coordinate. So this shape is just completely preserved as you go forward in time. You can shine your ball of electromagnetic fields and plasma at the black hole, and it does not scatter. The curvature does nothing. Nobody at future null infinity will see anything. So it's a very strange thing that can't happen in vacuum. And there's a connection with something called Robinson's theorem. For shear free null rays, if anyone's heard of that. All right, so I'll remind you of all the stuff. We spent a lot of time just talking about force free, and I think it's really lovely and has direct application in nature. We talked a bit about the opening of field lines, and then quickly at the end, these exact solutions we've found. So thanks for your attention. Oh, no, I don't think that, I think the reason though is mainly it's not physically relevant because even though the fields are so big, it's not going to affect the metric. Yeah, but no, nobody's done that, it'll be interesting. Oh, people have done, oh yeah, of course, for neutron stars. But you, but you. Yeah. Yeah, they just treat themselves consistently because it's easier for them than trying to fix the background.
Some simulations have been just turned on the source.
Okay.
We have them
on. Okay. Yeah.
That's cool. I want to think of these force free equations as describing an effective theory of QED in the region where air production is rampant, something like that. Think of this E squared has to be greater than V squared condition.
Less than,
due
yeah.
Due to the fact that perturbation only happens for electric fields and not magnetic fields.
Yeah, maybe. That would go, I mean, certainly, you know, you see energetic particles from pulsars. So there's probably some pair creation going on. And people have these, you know, there's a model for every person, you know, on where it's happening and how much and why. But there's no self-consistent description, you know, mathematical description based on what you said. So that would be really interesting to do and relevant.
So this last solution that you described, so it was in a spherical symmetry.
It's a spherically symmetric black hole background, although it also works in curve, but the force-free fields on that are not symmetric. They're literally an arbitrary initial packet or whatever of fields such that there'll be no radial current. That's all an assumption that goes in. I'm not saying every wave will not scatter, but this special class does exist for force-free. And it doesn't exist for vacuum. You can prove that. Everything scatters in vacuum. So I don't know why, but... Yeah.
So it's just coming out, that's going in. I don't think that one is covered.
Oh, okay. That's a nice comparison. Yeah.
That's dust, right? So that's
it. It's not dust.
Right, but this is.
Right, it's different.
Like vacuum, it's like magnetic field. So.
But this could be null dust. I mean.
Determined by.
Null charged dust is one possible physical, somewhat physical, realization of null current. Another one is, you know, a bunch of charge sitting there and, you know, a bunch of currents flowing. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe pulsars do shoot out particles at the speed of light. But that's not what you get from thinking about particles stuck on field lines in this ideal MHD. Sure, at some point, yeah.
This happens if you did for radiation, for the power that's radiated.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, that is, you can not use it all the way out.
Yeah, but I think you can argue that the power goes out to the region where the force free is no longer valid, and then something happens there. You know, the power gets converted into something. No, I don't. I haven't seen anything. Luis was saying there probably is, but it's hard to know because, I don't know, you don't... Yeah. I mean, what people do, I think, to the extent they do it, is they work out pair production rates based on some your favorite model of where it's happening and why, which necessarily goes beyond force-free. They call these places gaps, where the force-free doesn't hold for some reason. And they just write down a number of particles, and then you can compare the force-free solution you found numerically, which has some magnetic field, and you can compare that to the particle density and decide where it, how far out it goes.
Okay, let us think. time to get into a pure quantum 50 minutes.
Oh, man.